Welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
We're super excited today. We have a special guest, Carl Schrader. He's author of, I think, 10 novels, a variety of short stories, and is a certified futurist. So right up our alley as a guest, and we've enjoyed what we've read of his. So welcome, Carl.
Thanks. Really happy to be with you guys.
Do you have anything on the go that you're working on now?
I'm having this problem that I sometimes have where I thought I knew what I wanted to write and had an outline, and I pitched it to everybody, and they all smiled and nodded and said, "Oh yeah, that sounds great." And then while I was falling asleep the other day, I got walloped over the head with an idea out of left field, and now I'm going, "Ooh, maybe I'll do that instead." The last time that happened, I was going to write a sequel to my novel Permanence, and I ended up writing Son of Sons instead, which turned into a 5-book epic. So God knows where this will take me.
That's, a good problem, but also a dangerous one.
Yeah.
And what's the most recent book? Is it Stealing Worlds is the most recent you finished?
Yeah, Stealing Worlds came out from Tor Books in June. So not that long ago. Reviews are still coming out. It sounds like people are enjoying it. I'm going to be in Montreal next week. Next Thursday night, I'll be at Argo Bookstore in downtown Montreal doing a reading. And I've got a few other appearances and things lined up. So, it's all good.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
So, we were interested to talk to you because, from what we have read of yours, your books are really deeply political and like have economic thoughts seem to be baked right into the very basis of them.
It's in a lot of ways that's accidental, or maybe the result of a guilty conscience, because I find that. I've always found that I can't write about the future without thinking to myself, well, you know, it's not really going to be star-spanning empires with all kinds of advanced technology, and yet we still have kings.
That makes me so crazy. I can't. It feels so good to hear someone else say it.
I know. So every book I've written, I've sort of run up against this problem of, I can't believe what I'm writing. Unless I deal with the elephant in the room, and that is, how does the society actually work? And I mean that literally.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
How does work get done? Who owns things? Is ownership a thing? All these things. If only for my own, guilty conscience as I'm writing, I've got to settle those questions, even if the book's about something else entirely. So in my last novel, Lockstep, I invented a variation on the robot tax because I just had to.
it was out of your hands.
Corporations are not allowed to own multi-purpose robots. Only individual live human beings can.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of Roman situation where you send your slaves out to work and you live off the proceeds. But only you as an individual person can do this. Corporations can only own single-purpose production machines. That was fun, and it allowed me to address all kinds of things and then sort of tuck them into the background so that I could get on with the story, which is a situation I often find myself in. I've been dragged kicking and screaming into economics because I got 30% in mathematics in grade 11, and to me, money is just more math and something that I instinctively shy away from. But I do end up having to deal with it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. When I was reading it, but toward the end of Ventus, I started wondering about the world and the economy that had developed on the planet after, like, when the second wave of settlers arrived. And so that's like it was some number of hundred years later, and we're observing them, and they're sort of in like a feudal medieval sort of feeling culture.
Yeah, there's a couple of phases to the history in that novel. Just briefly, Ventus takes place about 1,000 years in the future. It's what my former editor, David Hartwell, used to call a big planet novel. it's all about the world of Ventus, which was terraformed by nanotechnology in advance of the human settlers. When the human settlers arrive, the global terraforming system doesn't recognize them. It treats them as an immune problem, or rather treats their technology as an immune problem. Doesn't have any problem with them because they're biological, but it destroys all of their technology and they're knocked back to the Stone Age. So the book takes place hundreds of years after they've clawed their way back to something resembling civilization. But they're only at what would be, I think, the sort of ancien regime, pre-revolutionary France stage of technology. And that, again, allowed me to play with social conditions and power dynamics that were much closer to the personal than we get in, say, a modern society. If you're being repressed by someone in Ventus, you're being repressed by someone. I really wanted to keep things at that level for that.
But. Yeah, yeah. Is there something there about like the way that societies develop, though, that it's sort of like there's an inevitability to it that they...
Oh, you know, I think you could easily read that book and say that I was making a deterministic argument about social development, but I really don't believe that. The great biologist Stephen Jay Gould claimed that if you reran the tape of evolution on Earth, you'd get completely different outcome. And I really do believe that if you reran our economic history, you get the same result. We have a tendency here in the West to look at economic development and historical development through the eyes of European history. But I would recommend a couple of books to anyone who has that kind of sort of has been educated that way. They're 1491 and 1493, which are both books about the Americas by Charles Mann.
Those are the years before and
the Americas before Columbus. And it isn't a central argument, but Mann talks a lot about, you know, how people lived in the Americas. And it was a completely different style of economics. But one of the forms that we're most familiar with, of course, is the potlatch economies of the Pacific Northwest. But there were lots of other structures. And you could imagine if Columbus had not arrived, that these civilizations would have just kept developing and wouldn't necessarily have gone through the stages that we think of as stages of economic maybe that's wrong, but I'm not actually in the business of being right. I'm in the business of coming up with really interesting ideas that hopefully spark people to think. And for me, this is a really interesting idea. It's fruitful. It's a productive idea, it's the kind of way that I like to think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought it was great. It was super interesting. The book for me sort of scratched both like my epic fantasy sort of itch of like it felt like you were in sort of a sword and sorcery world for a while, and then a little bit later you find out that there's actually like a really advanced civilization and you get that science fiction side of it. So it was a dual purpose
totally
book, right?
I wanted to write a book that read like high fantasy for the first half and then turned into hard science fiction.
Yeah,
because I hadn't seen anyone really do that, in terms of my own enjoyment, I succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. I was really happy with it.
Me too.
Thanks.
The other thing, so the idea of thalience. So oh, yes. Thalience is basically that things are able to like identify themselves or codify themselves. Is that right?
Yeah, thalience, it's an idea that has gotten a lot more traction than it probably deserves. But it is the core of Ventus as a book of ideas. And I don't always write books about ideas. Sometimes I just have fun. But in Ventus, I did both. And Thalience comes out of the old ancient philosophical question of can we get at how things are in reality? Can we know what's real behind the surfaces, right? Behind the appearances? And there have been, you know, thousands of different answers to that over the aeons. And I just suddenly, probably in the shower one day, thought to myself, well, why don't we just ask the things? Because now that we have computers, we can make things that can talk to us.
Yeah, right, right.
So aliens is the idea of physical objects having their own experiences and then communicating them to us. And the question is, isn't that the physical world waking up and telling us what it really is? And I don't know the answer.
I'm sorry, technical note. I've been thinking a lot about the sound because I'm hearing what the recorder's sharing, right?
Yep.
Yeah,
Carl's super quiet. Can we turn his input up on the board?
Let me move my mic closer.
That I think might help, yes.
Yeah,
but
is that better?
Because does he go into the board and then out to the recorder?
Well, yes.
Can we amp him up?
Be able to.
I'm really sorry to nitpick.
Talking at a good level on this end, so.
Yeah, I don't think it's a... I think it's a...
Okay, that should be better.
Yeah.
And
okay, how's this?
That's better. I can hear him more, yeah.
Yep, okay.
Okay.
Awesome.
Hope you can recover the beginning.
I hope so. I'm sure we'll be able to.
We can do a lot with post.
Yeah.
But I can...
Good.
The idea of thalience also to me felt like an anti-capitalist idea that instead of being able to sort of take things and use them however we wanted, it was sort of that those things could say to them for themselves, like, this is actually what I'm going to do, and there's limits to what I'll allow.
Ah, well, if you got that out of Ventus, then you're going to love Stealing Worlds.
Okay.
because that is the exact rabbit hole that I go down with that novel. Although, you know, it's not that I'm necessarily anti-capitalist, but that I've lost interest in the ideas of the last century and of the century before. So I'm not really interested in the solutions that, you know, people trumpet as being the one and only way that things can be. And for me, capitalism is just so 20th century. It's one of those things that it just bores me now, and I'm interested in seeing what comes next and what cool new stuff. And you'll find that there are you know, that attitude comes through in Stealing Worlds, but there's all kinds of tricks and trapdoors that I built into that book, where you might think that I'm advocating one position, when in fact I'm setting you up for a big fall. And it goes back and forth, but I love fun. But yes, the Thalians does ask the question of what rights non-human things have. When you start asking that question, then traditional ideas of ownership and of control start to fray quite seriously. There is one quote I'll give you from near the end of the novel, but maybe this will explain. It's kind of giving away one of the best quotes, but I'll do it anyway. Economics has always been about turning people into things. We are just reversing things.
Mm.
I
like that.
Yeah. If you're prepared for ideas like that, then you'll enjoy Stealing.
Great. Well, I mean, yes, it's been fun so far. Not that I'm not super far into it, but...
It was a roller coaster ride, right? But I sound like I'm being frivolous. I'm not. These are matters of concern for me. It's just it's always very important for me to not get too entrenched in ideas, to always maintain a state of play. And I guess a few years ago, I got a design degree, master's in strategic foresight and innovation from OCAD University here in Toronto. And yeah, that makes me a card-carrying futurist, although being a futurist is not what most people think it is. But part of design is the ability to throw out all of your preconceptions at any moment in order to keep moving forward. And Stealing Worlds is a good example of that, both in terms of what it shows and the process of writing it. With it and Lady of Mazes, I read both of those books three or four times before I got to the version that I was comfortable with. Ditto for the ideas. I didn't have an agenda, and then that I discovered my agenda.
That seems appropriate, though, that, yeah, you...
Some people would call it, in fiction writing, some people are outliners, and some people are what are called pants.
Yes.
Writing by the seat of your pants, right? I can be both, but this and Lady of Mazes are both pants.
So you just said that being a futurist isn't really what most people think of it as being. I've always thought being a futurist means that you go and talk to like large corporations, or you give keynote speeches and just sort of say, like, I don't know, rousing ideas about what comes next.
Everything will be fine.
Well, yeah. If you hire a futurist and he makes a prediction for you, fire him. Right. So, because the last thing that foresight, as we tend to call it, is about is making predictions. There's three different kinds of change. There's totally predictable things like we know the sun's going to rise at a certain point tomorrow morning, right? That's physics. And then there's trends like the world is heating up, although we don't know exactly what the implications of that. But the third thing is chaotic systems like human society that are inherently unpredictable. And your sort of wild-eyed futurist type who comes in and starts raving about flying cars and, you know, and genetic babies and all this kind of thing is usually trying to sell you kind of snake oil around predicting the unpredictable, predicting the future course of human society and future history. And that is complete crap. Can't do right. So what you can do is you can go in and talk to people who are faced with the dilemma of an absolutely unpredictable future and the absolute necessity of preparing for the future. And you can try and inoculate them against change or inoculate against surprise. So this is what it comes down to. Foresight is the science of surprise. How to minimize surprise for yourself. And if you're a company or a government, let's say, how to maximize surprise for your competitor.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really, really interesting things to be involved in. You're never an expert. You're always in the sort of Buddhist child mind state of really not knowing what's going on. But your job is to kind of get people to be in that state as well and to be happy about it.
Yeah, for sure.
So that when surprises and shocks happen, your organization, your government, you're not derailed. And this is one of the reasons why militaries have always been interested in foresight and why they actually tend to get it right, because they know that they are going to be surprised. But they also know that their job is to somehow achieve objectives despite surprise. So a lot of companies, a lot of municipalities, organizations at all levels can learn a lot from just taking that approach. It's a tough one, and it's a tough thing to communicate, which is why everyone ends up assuming that we're all about prediction.
Right, right.
If you guys want, I can make some predictions. and here's the trick, is that as long as you set all of your predictions to few years after you retire,
right,
then you'll be fine.
The Nostradamus method. You put it all along after you're dead and you'll be fine. So
generally, no, I have no predictions. I have self-driving cars and stealing worlds, but that's because they were fun.
Yeah.
So it's not like we don't know that the Mekong River Delta is going to be flooded in a climate change event and millions of people are going to be displaced, but it's possible. That's something that could happen. So
it's when you don't know the exact shock, but you know there is some shock that it becomes useful to start playing through the possibilities, which is what scenario planning is. You don't make a prediction. You make 10 predictions, all of which contradict each other. And you say, well, what are we going to do if this happens? What are we going to do if this happens? You end up with a deck, a suite of strategies. And then when it looks like one of them is starting to come true, you're able to pull out the card for that and say, oh, well, this is what we figured we might be able to do in this situation, rather than being a pantser when it comes to life and death decisions.
I think it'll be fine. We'll be okay. Michio Kaiku said everything will be okay, so we're just going to trust that's going to work out.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fusion reactors will get here.
That's how I personally get through life.
What you're proposing sounds like an incredible amount of effort.
Yes.
So someone's got to pay you.
A sort of constant re-education in the way things really are unfolding, as opposed to how you thought they were unfolding 6 months ago.
Yeah.
So it's a process of constantly throwing out what you thought. So it's not for everybody.
Sure.
And people who get into this come from wildly different backgrounds. Everything from management theory to film studies to forensic car crash investigator to medical technology. The number of different backgrounds gone into enforcement is just staggering.
It's very interesting. I always find, though, people, when they start talking about foresight scanning, anti-fragility is not far behind.
Yes.
So, for those who don't know what anti-fragility is, can you explain it? I don't think I can do it justice. I'm very prejudiced against it.
We, as human beings, have a tendency to set up organizational structures that work at a particular moment, and then we optimize the shit out of it so that we take away all the things that don't have to do with being perfect for what we're doing right here and right now. And what that ends up doing is making our systems really, really brittle, really fragile. And we have a similar thing in our own ideas of the future, in that we have a blinding revelation at some point in our life about the way things are going to go. And then we set our life, on a particular course as a result of that and stop paying attention. and yet the world, constantly keeps slinging itself off in a different direction. And our personal lives and our organizations are just not equipped for that. A fragile organization breaks when one thing goes wrong. For instance, in the North American economy right now, there's apparently one factory that produces the high-quality certain face masks that
could
be used in the event of a serious virus outbreak.
Sure. I think there's lots of things like that.
If that factory burns down, then all of a sudden we have nothing to protect ourselves if a new SARS outbreak happens. That's fragile. That's fragility.
Yeah.
Anti-fragility is when you've got an organization or culture or whatever that can withstand multiple shocks, multiple changes, multiple vectors of surprise, and just keep on going. A really good example of an anti-fragile organization is the Catholic Church, because it's been around for 2,000 years.
Yes.
And, continues to exist and thrives in literally every environment that it has thrown itself into. And one of the things that the people who fantasize about the future dream about is an anti-fragile human civilization, anti-fragile humanity. Our generation is being tested. So we're going to find out whether you're fragile or anti-fragile.
I think we know the answer to that.
Global climate change and ecosystem collapse that are going to test us. I will not make a prediction on the outcome. Mm-hmm.
That's something that also could change throughout time, though, right? Like, we could have had a society 500 years ago that was anti-fragile.
I'm losing your sound.
Any better? No, still?
Oh, now you can.
Yeah. Like, we could have had a society, say, some number of years ago that was anti-fragile and then optimized our society and made it fragile, right?
Right. Capitalism is really interesting in this sense because it is both anti-fragile and fragile in different ways. It's highly anti-fragile in that it's constantly reinventing itself according to whatever new circumstances come along. But it's highly fragile in that its discounting of externalities means that it's not prepared for when things circle around and basically come back at it, right? The changes that we're wreaking on the physical world right now, as a result of optimizing our economics like crazy for the last years or so, are just not something that those economics are actually prepared to deal with. So it's a really fascinating system in that because it's both successful and unsuccessful. Sometimes at the same time and in the same ways. Interesting to write about, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Not so much interesting to live through.
Isn't that how it always is, though? But, like, I guess, so drawing on, like, biology, though, like, because it feels like a tardigrade, are they anti-fragile or are they just very generalized? Like, they live through anything.
They're pretty anti-fragile, but there are a lot of organisms that are generalized. Human beings are highly generalized, although individually very fragile. But biology is a really interesting model for economics. And one of the most interesting things about it is its circularity. What we have right now is a once-through system for economics, where whatever's not mined is grown. Changed into something that we can use, and then after it's used, it's discarded. But the biological world doesn't work that way. Everything, except for the basic beginning of the biological food chain, where water and sunlight, carbon dioxide are made into life, everything else is fully recycled, fully reused at all times. Circular economics is just becoming a thing. But it really is something that we should have thought of centuries ago, that we should have been practicing. When I was talking about the economics of the Americas before Columbus, this kind of discovery of circularity isn't something that required advanced computers or technology. It could have been and should have been figured out a long, long time ago. We do tend to talk about older cultures living in harmony with nature. We generally have no idea what we're talking about. But what it could mean, or what it could have been, is deliberately modeling our economics circularity. We're at a point now where we're going to be forced, because otherwise we're going to drown.
Which is not as fun as it sounds.
Yeah. Some of us will just leave the planet and then proceed to do the once-through economy everywhere else, Mars. Just keep going that way. Well, but for the rest of us who have to live here, that's not an option.
Yeah, and there's efficiencies in the ecology that we can't monetize necessarily.
Yeah, it's so far beyond efficiency that I don't use that. Yeah. If it's essentially 100% efficient all the time, then what do you call it?
Well,
right? And that's really what the biological world is.
Well,
it's definitely something reach it attained economics. So naturally, I play with based. I do a bunch of that.
Yeah, I remember Radiolab did an episode about an apple orchard in China that increased its efficiency by using humans to to pollinate their flowers rather than insects. And everyone's like, see, we can do it better than the bugs. What's the problem? The bees are all dying out. And I'm like, oh, that's missing the... Right. That is... Well, oh, no.
One of the ways that you can be more efficient is by trying to be less efficient. If you optimize one part of a system rather than the whole system, then you create these huge imbalances that end up taking you down. That, again, is a great explanation for why we have to develop something beyond capitalism. Because capitalism is an optimizer for parts of the system, but not the system as a whole. In the biological, we have this idea about evolution that it proceeds in the direction of more efficiency and more complexity. But that's not true. Any new organism, any new mutation could make an organism more complex or less complex than its parents. It can go either way. It's what's called a random walk. And right now we are engaged in a conscious drive to make everything as efficient as possible rather than finding ways to make things contribute to the system, I guess. And I don't mean in that system as a demand. Anything like that. I mean the overall structure of the workings of our planet,
like the hydrological cycle, or
maybe sometimes we should slow things down. There's a lot of stuff that we do that we're getting better and better at doing that are just piling up waste faster and faster. Mm-hmm. So yeah, all of this interests me.
Yeah, because
I you know, life's far too short to explore all of it.
Well, fair enough. But yeah, because I mean, this is kind of, for me, this is kind of building up to then kind of a lecture I heard you give about 2009, I think, ish, where you said kind of we should give wetlands the vote.
Yes. I've written about this in a couple of places. And again, I return to it, Stealing Worlds. I have a project I call the Deodans. A Deodan, it's an old English word, it comes from old English law. Given to God. But it was an old English legal concept where, let's say, a physical object had killed someone, so a cart rolled down a hill and killed someone. That cart would become a deodan. It would not be owned by anyone. It would become a ward of the state, and you could litigate it against it, sue it. You could have it put on trial and executed. All kinds of things. And I've sort of rescued this concept for the 21st century by supposing that artificial intelligence could have a completely different purpose than the ones that we've imagined. It should tend to be, you know, optimizing business processes or killer robots, basically one of the two. Or sex bots, I guess. there could be another alternative use for AI, and that, for me, would be to create deodans, to create entities that believe they are specific natural systems. So an AI that thinks it's a forest, an AI that thinks it's a watershed, AI that thinks it's a pod of whales, and acts as a rational economic actor in its own interests.
So an AI Lorax.
So the pod of whales acts in its own interests. The forest acts in and you know, when I came up with this idea, it was pretty wacky and fun. But then this new technology called the blockchain came along and distributed autonomous corporations and smart contracts. And all of a sudden, a few years ago, I realized that it would actually be possible right now to start to create entity space. And so I'm trying to do that with the help of some blockchain experts that I why not create it? Why not let the Amazon fight for its own rights? Why not give people the ability to invest directly in the natural world rather than going through Greenpeace or our governments through all kinds of third parties to try and reestablish some kind of relationship with the alienated nature. Why don't we just have a direct one-to-one relationship with the things of the natural world and literally go into business with them for mutual profit? In this case, of course, what the Amazon considers profit is, of course, more trees, less people. you know, how it achieves that is its own business, but there are many mutually beneficial ways that we and the awoken natural world could work together. For me, this is an idea that goes beyond merely circular economics into a completely new paradigm for our relationship with nature. It's beyond killer robots. It's beyond just optimizing economic processes. I don't think I'm done exploring this. I think there's some wonderful stuff that's yet to discover.
I think it's extremely rich, and I super hope you keep going with this, because I heard that and I was like, aha, yeah, that's awesome.
Well, a lot of people have an aha reaction when they hear this, when they finally understand it, because it takes a bit to sort of wrap your head around it. But then people start to get excited. And to me, that's an indication of something.
Would we have to have some sort of agreement to recognize these deodands?
Well, it's interesting. A few years ago, the Whanganui River in New Zealand was granted legal personhood. And in February of this year, Lake Erie was granted legal personhood.
Oh.
As far as the legal system in Ohio and maybe the U.S. in general is concerned. What this does is it allows people to litigate on behalf of these entities. And in the case of the Whanganui, there's a board that's been set up to administer its affairs. So all that I'm doing, because this is a trend, this is the sort of thing that's happening more and more, personhood for natural systems. All that I'm suggesting is that having a board of human beings to oversee the affairs of the Whanganui River is kind of like asking the fox to guard the hen house.
Yeah.
Why not give it its own ability to manage its own affairs? We have the technology to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Systems of smart contracts can be made completely autonomous and completely incorruptible. That's what blockchain technology gives us the ability to do. And if that's possible, then you can have an incorruptible mind for the Whanganui River. Why not? I see these things as partners and natural partners, because we're part of the ecologies that are being woken up in this. So our interests are their interests.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know it sounds crazy, but you know,
not at all.
I mean, I like the idea of it. That I'm just thinking, like, do we have separate personhoods for the fish in Lake Erie, or is it all like
so it's probably Eleanor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize in economics for her work on commons arrangements, called it polycentric governance. And in a polycentric system, you have nested entities, each of which has freedom within its own sort of boundaries, but it's part of a larger system. And she imagined a global system of commons nested in one another and governed directly by the people. This, again, is an alternative to capitalist and traditional socialist approaches. When I was writing Stealing Worlds, I found that there was a natural fit with the idea of the deodands, this sort of structure. So for a while, I was calling the deodands self-administering common pool resources. And it gets a bit crazy at points in Stealing Worlds where minds are assigned to all kinds of different things. The way that an algorithm can be assigned to a game sprite in a computer game and run it. So at one point, the main character is Sura, and at one point she's carrying groceries. And the groceries have a chatbot associated with a tiny mind that's also been associated. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, hurry up. You got to get us across town faster. You know, it's like you're doing an Uber delivering pizzas, and the pizzas are egging you on. Right? everything can have this kind of entity associated. So there are bricks that dream about being parts of buildings, and they negotiate with other bricks to try and come up with architectural plans and get the local craftsmen interested in using them. It just ramifies and goes all over the place and gets crazy. Lots of fun. It's all deeply interconnected. The idea of the commons, the idea of autonomous sets of systems of contracts that are made possible now by blockchain. The idea of sensor systems, like I described in Mendes, where the natural world can sense itself. In order for the Whanganui River to be able to want something, it has to know when it's healthy and when it isn't. We now have the technology to have that determined autonomously, too. We're living in a really interesting moment that I don't think most people are remotely aware of. But I think there are these giant sort of strategic foresight shocks rushing at us really quickly. And I think other uses for AI, other visions of artificial intelligence are one of those potential shocks.
Well, yeah, I think...
Frankly, a complete revolution in economics that might not go in directions that we expect.
Well, yeah, I think that's very important. And I think there's this notion that concept, like on the one side, you have like, I feel like it's a dichotomy, like on the one side, you have like this luxury space communism idea that like one day we'll just, you know, yeah, we'll get all the technology and then everyone will get everything they want and it will be fine. You know, fully automated luxury space communism, I think is the term. Right. Have you heard this? Yeah. And that sounds horrible.
It's interesting, but I want to flesh out those ideas if we're going to talk about it at all. Getting back to Eleanor Ostrom, when you talk about ownership, one of the ideas that she talks about a lot is rights bundles. Rights bundles are a key concept in commons, and have become more so since. I'll give you a concrete example. So let's say you buy a piece of property, and if you're incautious, you might buy the land rights, but not the mineral rights. And then somebody comes in and buys the mineral rights and digs a giant hole in the middle of your back pasture, right? But even if you are cautious, you'll find that you don't own the flyovers. No matter how much money you throw at that bit of farmland, a 747 can still fly over. And that's because you own a particular bundle of rights pertaining to that tract of land. And I think one of the really fruitful ways for us to start thinking about ownership in general is that we can own bundles of rights, but never the whole thing. Because there's always some level of scale, or whether it's the airspace over your land, or what gets passed down to your children and grandchildren, where your rights and ownership just doesn't make sense. Now that we're realizing that we live on a very finite planet, where what anyone does affects everybody else, I think it's going to become pretty clear pretty quickly that there have to be some kind of limits on what all of us. And for me, the fun thing is to create the deodands as the spokes entities of these limits. But to make that concrete, to think about it in the real world, I think we have the computing power now to be able to administer a world of rights bundles rather than I just buy a car and I have the car. Corporations are already doing this. If you buy a John Deere tractor, it turns out that you don't own the rights to the software.
Which is very frustrating.
Doing this kind of thing. But we could all play in this and say, well, okay, if you can't own all the rights to that, or if I can't own all the rights to that, maybe you can't own all the rights to whatever has an effect on my ability.
Yeah.
So,
But
and that's a sort of really fruitful.
Yeah, I just have this fear that like you'll get this system, and but there will not be like a one side, basically the entrenched corporate power will just outlitigate the other side, right? Like,
sure.
You can make the river a person.
This is one of those threats that weaves in the book as well, because for everything like this that you invent, somebody will try and invent a worker, right?
Yeah.
Especially if there's money.
Yeah, like what's the version of getting your kneecaps broken? For the what's the name of the river? Or for like Lake Erie. Like what can it go so far into debt that it's like, yeah, okay, dump those metal oxides in me. Like I need to get out of my, you know. And everyone's is fine.
Yeah, enforcement turns out to be the interesting question. And I come up with an answer for that in the Stealing Worlds. But I kinda had to, you know, get a little hand wavy because in the real world right now, sure, you can give the Wanganui River person. You can give it rights, but who's going to enforce those things? How that works is it's not simple, and it's not settled, and I think it's going to involve a new kind of social conflict, but it isn't necessarily something that requires a giant revolutionary change where we all change. This is something I think could evolve as a new system. War is. For me, this is an unfinished question. Power has to be backed up by something. And how just power is backed up has always been fraught with.
I am all for AI eco-Soviets forming and building. This is very exciting.
That's a great term, and I should have just called it Soviets. Then I would be really hugely controversial right now. And my name would be all over the place. Sadly, I'm not that smart.
All right.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah.
My one of my last questions. I probably will have more now, but do you have any like other book recommendations for us?
I would highly recommend. Infomocracy by Malka Older, and To Like the Lightning by Ada Palm. Those are both books that explore near and midterm utopian / dystopian ambiguous futures, and have a lot to say about governance, economics, the future of society. Both fantastic works of literate and fun science fiction.
Policy first, all the way.
I'm really excited for when the third and fourth books of Two Like the Lightning are. I think maybe just the fourth one is we're waiting on now.
Another book I would recommend is Wild by Brenda Cooper. Is talking about again the mid future of the global climate crisis and future America towards the end of this century, and how it could play out. Really interesting stuff about robots rebuilding the ecosystem and people being kicked off their land so it can be rewilded, and people fighting back against that. Yeah, so those three books would make a great reading list just from the last year or so.
Yeah, it's an exciting field. We're really enjoying being observing it unfold, I think.
Yeah, well, in a lot of ways, this is sort of big. I think now is the golden age of science fiction. This is so much really interesting stuff. I'm really, really so excited.
I've complained to people before that we seem to have named the golden age far too soon. Like,
yeah,
science fiction had barely been born, and we're like, oh, this is the best it's ever going to be.
We're done.
It's the golden age. I was like,
Well, yes, you know, I tend to cynically say that things are never so bad that they can't get worse, but things are never so good that they can't get better as well. We have some significant problems we need to fix, but if we can get through that, if we can, you know, bite the bullet and do the things that need to be done, the future is unimaginably bright, unimaginably exciting. Mm-hmm. I am and always have been an optimist, and I remain optimistic despite everything that's happened, because so many times in history, we haven't been prepared for the shock of the good.
Yeah.
If I had one thing to say, I guess to wrap up, it's that the shocks and surprises that face us aren't necessarily bad. We should be ready for grand, wonderful things to happen. And so much the better if we help make
them. Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. This was really great. And I think I can speak for Marshall when I say we'd love to have you back.
Yeah, sometime.
I want to talk surveillance with you. I feel we didn't touch it. That's what I came in. I was really excited to talk about surveillance. Yeah, well, this is the and we talk about manifolds. Like the
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if people want to keep up with what you're doing and when you have things coming out and everything, how's the best way for them to do that?
I've got a presence on Twitter. You can just find me at Carl Schrader. And I have a website, kschrader.com. And I'm on Facebook. Between those things. And there's a sign-up sheet on my website where you can get a far too infrequent newsletter emailed out to you that'll tell you what I'm doing.
Great. Yeah. Thanks so much. I'm Marshall. You can find me on Twitter at EconoBoyd.
Yeah. And I'm Steven, and I can be found at SteveDroids with an S.
Great. Yeah. Thanks so much. It's really helpful for if you share this with your friends to get more listeners for us. And also going on Apple Podcasts and rating and reviewing the show really helps us out a lot. Thanks.